listening to atoms, motion, and the void. I play checkers, or more accurately, Cheskers, with Sheriff Ray once a month. As we are both somewhat fallen off the radar screen, immune to friendship, and by our own estimations, generally better off alone, it is a meeting that would never take place had we not invented the game during a sneak attack madrigal at the local high school. To begin with, I had been seated in the turbulently bobbing bleachers, which both rolled out and against the wall on a sea of casters and shuddered with the movement of every audience member. I would never have, in the direct knowledge of this madrigal, condoned it for myself as the feature of my evening. But earlier that day, I had been handed a free ticket and told that the performance itself was a thing of complete mystery. Had I seen the black bus driving through town? Not even the ticket distributor knew the first thing about the event, or who or what was inside the bus, only where it was to be held and when. The mystery turned out to be a visiting club of operatic and pointy-haired boys, who, though teenagers themselves, had composed their own vocal music. This rare delight was touring the land in a black-painted bus, distributing free and self-enhancing mystery tickets ahead of themselves. So I sat in the dimmed and swaying seats of the bleachers in the basketball court of the local high school and listened to the homemade songs of the Black Bus Boys, as they dubbed themselves. The first three songs barely reached my ears, and I wondered if the songs themselves were sub-audible, as to add a sheen of replacement mystery to the rather lackluster one that had been revealed. But then suddenly, in the fourth song, all the boys shot down on their knees, imploring the unlit Klieg lights in the rafters with a group scream of such damaging note that for my safety and the preservation of my future enjoyment of music, and due the ship's nausea of the bleachers, I shoved myself down to the floor and went out into the trophy hall and thenceward on toward the cafeteria. As he was required to do at all after-school events, Sheriff Ray stood guard near the vending machines. "A game, sir," Ray said, in his drawling backroom way, one hand on his gun, the other on what looked like a counterbalancing brick on the far side of his utility belt. The sheriff is one of those laconic, old-time persons who, though yet young and frail, has a deep, cowboy-flavored voice that does the whole work of his being. He cannot be anyone's physical idea of a sheriff, yet he has come to be regarded as essential to the well-being of Lemon. He is the only man I know who has gained both the security of his job and the safety of his town through the smoky temper of his throat. It is a stick waving in the campfire sort of voice that strikes a sentinel chord. Trouble may be near, but as long as the sheriff's voice is stirring the flames, all may sleep soundly in the reflected warmth. While the sheriff is almost never completely serious, he is also ever indifferent to final results. So when he asked me if I wanted a game, I knew it was both a joke and a viable offer. On the cafeteria table behind him was a motley spillage of board games, which the students were permitted to play during their study halls. As I was still uneasy from the seasickness, and because there is pleasure maintaining a muffled contact with the thing one has narrowly escaped, be it a car accident or a boys' concert, I sat down. We sifted through the different boxes until we found a checkerboard, and then began to herd our checkers together from the pile of spinners and dice and fake money and other assorted tin and plastic gewgaws. What we assembled finally was a very poor facsimile of anything. We each had 7 or 8 checkers and 7 or 8 chess pieces. Our first game was meant to be outright checkers, with the salvaged chess pieces being lobotomized to the element of checker chips. But at some point, and this is a place of permanent disagreement between the sheriff and I, one of us, and I'm certain it was I, forgot that his large wooden queen was a stand-in for a simpleton checker, and swung it across the board to capture a knight. The other one of us, the sheriff in my reckoning, did not hesitate at all and brought his checker bishop into play, cutting off the retreat of the queen. Paralyzing the chess piece in a prison of checkers became the principal action of our new game. By the end of this first game, and with some easily found rules, we had invented Cheskers, which we like to say, or I do, is harder than chess, but easier than checkers, and twice as fun as both. In chess, one tries to position one's pieces in such a way that the king is essentially assassinated. In checkers, you simply hop around, half asleep, collecting the other player's unloved serfs in an anesthetic war of attrition, like boys collecting valueless stones at the river until saturated with boredom. In Cheskers, the object is to trap different pieces where they stand, to essentially paralyze your opponent until all his pieces are becalmed, at which point you must yell out, "Madrigal," as that is what Sheriff Ray said, loudly but not emphatically, when he defeated me that very first game, which victory, I should say, he co-signs as proof of his authorship of it, and which word he had in fact uttered separately to signal his need to return to duty, as the pointy-haired boys had completed their mysterious performance. Now, if this were a game already in fashion, I have no doubt that Sheriff Ray and I would never come together for our monthly match-up. But not only was I heated for a second match, vaguely sad that I had lost the first ever Cheskers contest the world had ever seen, but also because we had invented it and wondered if our pleasure might be constant in future games, that we scheduled a second match-up at the station the following evening. This was several years ago, and our monthly tournament continues to this day. One of the developed delights is the moment of warmth that follows the completion of the game, where the victor is forced to call out, "Madrigal," which embarrassing cry then becomes a kind of victory for the loser. Even this element we find astonishing, that the game provides a victory to both parties, where the loser can lurk behind raised eyebrows and suggest that the game was lost on purpose so that the other had to shout out the feebly majestic word. But our game also persists because we hope, perhaps as Professor Theremin did back in his time with his invented eponymous instrument, that our game will leap forward upon the public imagination, and that across the world will soon arrive the more regular shout of "Madrigal," which word, I should say, is now our official game title. To ourselves we call it Cheskers, but if ever any game maker comes along to inquire, we would say the game was called Madrigal. But all this is to say that it was through the agency of our game that I came to hear and bear witness to the mysterious story of the flashlight Jaspers. I had lit his office candle with my pocket matches, and we sat in the flickering room on a cold night, evenly established across the board, with a good portion of each other's pieces heartily immobilized by our blind and heartless checkers, when the phone rang in the gloomy station house. The sheriff, as was his practice, stood from his chair to take the call, as though he may have to run off without a lost second, and which excitement has the tendency to make me rise, as though I were his eager deputy. The moment he hung up the phone, and with our game incomplete, we both rushed away for his cruiser, heading for the back hill roads, and making our way up to the little blue bonnet house on the hill where the Jaspers lived. "I'll sail down the street in my new fancy car. I will rise through the buildings to the sky like a star. There's a house in Eden, even though I've lost cross my way. And I'll be there shortly. This is just a brief delay. As we drove, the sheriff filled me in on his stock of specifically sheriff-style knowledge on the flashlight Jaspers. 2 or 3 times a year, the sheriff told me, he received a hushed and urgent phone call from someone passing through town. It was always a stranger, never anyone from Lemmon, as everyone in Lemmon knows about the curious family on the hill. But the caller almost always says something like this: "There's a little blue house on a hill that's being robbed right now. There must be 4 or 5 of them ransacking the place." Such a caller will typically begin in increasing strain and agitation, as Sheriff Ray will have greeted their call to action with sighs and some ironic laughter. "So what you're saying," Sheriff Ray would say, following his habit of repeating the accumulated information in what he calls the dog pile of facts. "So what you're saying is that you're from out of town, just passing through, stopped at the cafe and found it closed, proceeded east up Main Street, looking for even a vague possibility, your words, of a restaurant, when your husband gazed out the window and saw, across the Lemon Pond, a little blue house on a hill, with all 4 windows ablaze, with what appeared to be a number of lightsaber battles underway. Again, your words there, ma'am, the Star Wars words. But which lightsaber battles, upon closer inspection, because you stopped the car and stood on a snowbank, your husband and yourself, both with 20/20 vision, your husband a pilot, you with no prior history of glasses, soon clearly revealed itself to be not the fallout of a Jedi encounter, but instead the even more alarming situation of a house robbery in progress, that you were witnessing the strobing effect of many, many flashlights shining around in the different rooms. A 211, ma'am, is what I'd call it in police code, if there was anyone else to call it 2, but I'm all there is here in Lemmon. And to answer your earlier question, I am my own supervisor." After a moment, and usually following remarks from the caller that the sheriff was not meeting the peril of the 211 with any degree of law enforcement, that his indifference was an impertinence that could not be tolerated, Sheriff Ray would say, sometimes simply to get off the phone, "No need to worry, ma'am. That's just the flashlight Jaspers, and they're doing just fine." If the caller were particularly aggressive or insulting, as I say, he might hang up there. But if they were kindly and worried, and permitted him the leeway to consider the 211 in the casual mood and manner that he preferred, he might go on to describe how there are 3 distinct sets of Jaspers living in Lemmon: the Valley Jaspers, the Old Jaspers, and the Flashlight Jaspers, all of whom are aptly named. The one family living in the valley, the one couple being quite old, and a flashlight Jaspers, being heavy users of flashlights. The general understanding in town is that the Jaspers began to use flashlights at night to negotiate their home when, 20 years earlier, half a forest had fallen over their power lines during a storm and sheared them from the grid. Those who like the Jaspers tend to believe that they thereupon made a stand of sorts against the electrical inklings of the modern world, and those who do not like to say that Vernon Jasper had refused to clear his property of the requested amount of trees, as was his responsibility in the contract with the power company, in order to restore the power. Regardless, a stubborn feud of some kind commenced, in which nothing happened except the trees grew and the Blue House Jaspers became the Flashlight Jaspers. Often, the sheriff is forced by the concerns of his caller to lament the fact that, yes, it was possibly sad that the three Jasper girls didn't have indoor plumbing and could never watch television or have their fingers on the world and the world in their eyes in the form of the internet, as was the modern tabernacle. But who really knew what was the best route forward? The girls seemed happy, if underdressed, and there wasn't anything illegal about it besides. But most interesting to note to such callers, who make it as far as that, and a fact that will sometimes cause them, if they have the time, to find a nearby hotel, or to return at some point in the future, the sheriff might tell them that the Flashlight Jaspers run their own museum. You can visit every Friday and Saturday night from 4 to 8, and it costs $5 per person, he will inform them. But fair warning, arrive early and bring cash. $30 is the amount of money they spend on batteries per week, and $30 is all they care to collect. So only 6 people ever get in. For $5 you get a flashlight and can freely roam about the dark house as long as you like until 8, watching them make dinner, do what they do, fetch water from the well, visit the outhouse, all with Mrs. Jasper serving as a fairly quiet and unobtrusive docent. The Jaspers are considered by some to be entrepreneurial pioneers and by others to be frauds. Television glow light has been spotted spoiling on their walls. Toilets have also been heard flushing inside the house. Some reconnaissance missions during the open hours of the museum by overly zealous local citizens, who secretly tour the house in the guise of tourists looking for signs of toilets and televisions, have so far proved fruitless. Another point that is generally conceded and lends some credence to the claims of fraud: in the middle of the cold winter, no smoke issues from the Jasper chimney, or, I should say, rare smoke, as the vernacular has arranged itself in such discussions. And yet, the family will be seen in the cinema of flashlight windows, going around their rooms, half-naked. Many people like to say this, that the Flashlight Jaspers go around half-naked. But really, it's more accurately a kind of unstateliness. Vernon Jasper wears enormous tennis shorts inside the house and a kind of puffy vest. The girls and Mrs. Jasper all wear handmade shifts, garments made from sheets or tablecloths, folded in half and stitched shut and then cut for the entrance of a human body. But when people say half-naked, what they really mean is that the Jaspers are notorious for not wearing undergarments. There is no official proof of this. Again, it is pure speculation, based, I think, in large part by the fact that the dirty-footed Jaspers rarely wear shoes and never socks, and that a kind of transitive appraisal arrives, an insinuation of nothingness that, while not necessarily true, feels most naturally likely. If they don't wear shoes or socks, and their dresses are tablecloths, and Mr. Jasper wears no shirt beneath his puffy vest, certainly there is very little to indicate or suggest that such a family should dress in any way beneath themselves. I have often seen the Jasper girls at the edge of town, huddling like mildly tame deer, curious for headlights, at the intersection of the paved road and the long and rutted Jasper driveway, where they hold up a sign on Friday afternoons advertising the Flashlight Jasper Museum, which roadside activism is considered lascivious and vaguely pornographic, as though the girls were the leggy sideshow invitation to a potential brothel in the muddy woods. As it turned out, however, on our particular night, in the middle of our game, it had not been a breathless tourist calling to report flashlights in the house. In fact, the sheriff had received a call from the Allnuts, who live in a half-completed, falling-apart home about 200 yards down the hill from the Jaspers. I don't know exactly what Mr. Allnut said, but Sheriff Ray grew more alarmed than I have ever seen him, even at the ambiguous prospect of winning a game of Cheskers, as more than anything he likes to win, and less than anything else, he dislikes having to call out Madrigal. But he finally said heavily and shakingly and with great worry, "So no flashlights for 2 hours, and you can't get Vernon on the can. We'll take a drive up there." It was likely not protocol that I be brought along on this official investigation, but perhaps because our game was incomplete, or because I was standing in my deputized manner, or even because the mood of the adventure seemed outside the framework of the typical law or the work of a sheriff, he included me without any consultation, and I went without any wonder. "I sing with the birds so the sky stays away. I sleep in the trees with the fish in the lake. So I guess I'll go lay down in the clouds. My sister's gone to lay out in the fields. We always lay down in the ground looking for the lost and found that we lost and found. I tied down the earth, but the dawn never tires. I shut down the stones, but these folks won't retire. So we all go lay out on the ground looking for the lost and found that we lost. As we arrived in the yard, our gaze wandered slowly over the dark face of the house. There was no moon, but a cloudy appeal in the sky, and the sudden wind whips promised the arrival of a storm. I noticed the sheriff overly fidgeting at his utility belt. He didn't seem to want to look at it, so keen was he to observe the gloomy windows. But finally he relented and sighed. "Forgot my flashlight," he said. There should be plenty inside, I guessed. You ever been in there? He asked pointedly. No, I said. It's a maze of emptiness, he said, and strode forward. Part of the Jasper's Luddism included a lack of locks. I had heard that they had no keys or locks of any kind on their doors, but this was not exaggerated enough, as there was not even a knob on the front door, and it pushed open as faintly and silently as a curtain. The sheriff called out for Vernon and Mrs. Jasper, and then after a moment asked if anyone was home. We stood in the darkness of what I imagined was the kitchen from a light sound of dripping. My first discovery was what seemed to be a series of towels covering the floor. I kicked at these and lifted up a heavy ball of cloth. The sheriff reached through the darkness and touched this clue and then said simply, "That's their bed. They sleep on the floor, on a sheet or two and whatever else." I at first thought I might perhaps remake their bed of floor sheets. But then both the sheriff and I froze as the tiniest insect of a voice could be heard buzzing on the far side of the room. I heard the soft clacket of the sheriff drawing his pistol from its holster. He pushed at me as a way of telling me to stay where I was, but nevertheless I crept along behind him, dragging the Jasper's soft bed with me. Despite nearing the wall and not meeting any resistant objects along the way, the voice did not get any louder, but almost seemed to be retreating through the walls. The sheriff holstered his gun and then grumbled with understanding. I heard the sound of a tin can knocking against the wall. "It's just the can," he said. A small voice inside the can said, "Vernon, is that you?" The sheriff raised the can to his mouth. "Tom, it's Sheriff Ray." "No, no sign of him yet, but at least we know the can works." The can, as it turned out, was a kind of primitively advanced telephone system that consisted of a special kind of sound-conducting wire and two tin cans, one hanging from the Jasper wall and another installed a few hundred yards away at the Allnuts. After a few moments of conversation, the sheriff released the can to bang sloppily against the wall. He turned to me and said, "I'm gonna run down to the Allnuts and grab their flashlight and be back in 10 minutes. He requested that I go outside and stand near the car during this errand, and I said I would, after first returning the Jasper bed back into some semblance of a square. The sheriff departed in haste, and I set about the floor, attempting to find the corners of the baffling sheet. During this interval of bed-making, the storm fully arrived. Rain splashed down on the metal roof, and heavy winds pushed up the house walls, making the windows tight. In fact, the ambient forces had so powerfully shifted that I found it impossible to get the knobless front door open, as it had become pressure-lodged within its casement. A simple tool would help, a screwdriver or knife, even a fork, to wedge it out of the jam, and so I at once began to make my way around the room again, foolishly miring myself in the bedsheets once more, which I now kicked into a corner as a sign of my new freedom from such politeness. I felt along the wall and found nothing. I roved across the floor, and again, there was nothing. Aside from the sheet and the can, the room was entirely empty. I found a door beside the can and pushed, with some difficulty, through it. Like the front door, it was both knobless and firmly held in place by the vacuum created by the outside winds. This room was, I thought, smaller, but essentially the same. In one corner, my feet managed to ruin what I imagined was one of the girls' floor beds. There was no can in this room, nor could I return to the first from the great sucking pressure against the door. A maze of emptiness indeed. I took a moment to look out the window at the calm gleamlessness of the police car. The distant trees were steadily thrashing in the rain, and the nearest pane of glass itself was damp and nervous in its glazing. I found another door and entered another empty room with another ruinable floorbed, which I finally managed not to disturb. I again glanced out the window at the trees in the dark thrust of the wind. What in the world, I wondered, could so activate the jaspers that they must swing their flashlights so vigorously around such empty rooms? There were no objects to negotiate aside from the beds, and nothing interesting to observe. I pushed open the door of what I assumed, from my sense of the structure, was the last of the four rooms. There were no windows at all here, and the space was as black as oil. As I could not tolerate the idea of being locked in a room, deleted of its light, without any possibility of retreat, I grabbed up the bed material, ruining the only bed I had managed to preserve, and propped it into the jamb to keep the door from pressure shutting. I must need to be pushed to the very edge of the pirate's plank for my mind to properly function, as it was here, in the absolute darkness of the fourth room, that I remembered the matches in my pocket, the matches I always brought to light the candle in whose light the sheriff and I play our game. As the rust of flame suddenly sparkled in the room, I froze with a devastating softness of limb. Beneath my skin, my entire electrical body seemed to perish. For there, scattered across the floor of the room and absolutely frozen, were all five Jaspers. Vernon and Mrs. Jasper were standing to alert, and the three children sat at their feet. All of them held unlit silver flashlights, which they aimed at me in their instinctive way. They blinked and stared and pointed their dark flashlights at me as I gazed out from the small hole of my shock. And then I understood. Mrs. Jasper winced, and Vernon moaned softly, and the littlest of the Jasper girls smiled up innocently. In the corner of the room was a small white toilet, and before them, mounted on the wall, was the most enormous flat-screen television I have ever seen. I stared at them a moment longer. The storm had died down, as though upon the discovery of their secret, and a looseness went through the house and my body. After leaving the room, I would try to get Mr. Allnut on the can. I would tell him that the Jaspers were all fine and well, and if he would be kind enough to tell the sheriff all this, that I would meet him at the car. But before I left, and with the breath that I used to blow out the match, I whispered out a single word to their paralyzed forms, as though I were the universe calling a temporary end to that day's match. Madrigal, I said. Madrigal. Soften, steel girder, find the bends. The backbone of the city till the end. Like bluebells on mountainside, smoke on the sea, the sidewalk. And diaries won't set you free. These are the fingerprints of the fallen down. I shadow turned you upside down. Cracked
stand hung in broken shame. So come take me home again, we'll soon regret the sidewalks and diaries, dance and forget. These are the fingerprints of the falling down. How your shadow turns you upside down. What's all of it but failure crown? Starting to see the sky. Glory am I, I'm starting to see the sky. Glory am I, I'm starting to see the sky. Glory am I, I'm starting to see the sky.
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void.